Welcome to the bookshelf. Tonight we begin African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011.
I want to dedicate this book to Dinga, my African sister, and for all of those who, though small, are a big presence, whose lives, though short, drench the world with color, and whose hearts, though beating irregularly, effectively and unforgettably teach ours. Dinga died at the age of 14, Wednesday, May 20, 2009, of a mitral valve prolapse during yet another fight with malaria.
Part 1, African Rice Heart.
I remember the first day my African host family allowed me to draw water up for my morning bucket shower. Before that day, they did everything for me. They didn't allow me to lift things, to stand, or to do work of any kind. One of the other volunteers told me that this was their way of welcoming me, and that I'd offend them if I insisted too soon to be treated like everyone else. But their kindness made me feel like this ritzy American sissy, distant and different. So after 2 weeks, I put my foot down and said that I'd get the water for the shower myself. Going to our open-air well, which isn't lined, isn't capped, and isn't treated, I grasped the end of a very dirty rope and tossed the plastic bucket, which was cracked from hauling heavy loads, down into the greenish liquid. Then, peering down into the well, I waited for the bucket to fill. Instead, it stubbornly floated. I jerked the rope right and then left, trying to catch the lip of the bucket in the water so it would fill. Eventually it did catch, but then it submerged completely and came up too full and heavy. I tried to pull the bucket up like I'd seen my African siblings do, hand over hand and away from the dirt wall of the well, but it scraped the whole way up, scooping dirt off the wall, and then that became a brown layer across the water's surface. Sucking up my pride, my fast diminishing pride, I struggled to keep my knee-length blue and white striped bathrobe modestly tied shut while I carried the bucket across the courtyard. I leaned far to the right to counter the weight of the water, which was pulling my left arm and shoulder down, and the water sloshed against my calf and ran down my ankle. The people who were watching tried not to laugh. I was embarrassed. As I entered our outdoor shower room, my stomach turned at the sight of yellow puddles and the sweet stench of urine. The shower room was also the site of the activity described by the French verb pisser. Bricks were scattered on the ground, and you were supposed to be able to stay above whatever was below you by standing on them, but that smell, there's no way to avoid it. I set my bucket in one corner of the mud enclosure and then tipped it slightly, washing some of the urine out of the drain hole. Then I did the slow, careful dance across the bricks, draped my towel, bathrobe, and underwear over the wall, and stood there naked, wondering once again just how this shower was going to actually get me clean. I'm pretty sure I've never quite been that exposed. And I'm not even referring to the literal exposure, the way my body was sandwiched between the open sky and the ever-present dirt, those white birds peering down at me and the malarial mosquitoes penetrating my personal space and landing on me rudely. No, I'm talking about the exposure to everything unfamiliar in the Chadian culture, everything I couldn't swallow. As I thought about how exposed I was, I peered over the wall and saw Dinga, my 14-year-old African sister, pounding rice for the evening meal. Dinga had a lot of power in her thready biceps. Her wrists flexed as she slammed the pole down to crush the kernels that lay in the wooden bowl. Sometimes, when she'd throw the pole up, she'd let go of it, clap twice, show off her skillfulness, and then catch the pole again, her arms re-engaging with that surprising force. She was working alone, and she was sweating. We eat rice almost every meal here. It brings force, the Chadians say, which I would translate more like something like, it fills our bellies, because white rice really has very little nutritional value. But it means survival nonetheless. Making the rice edible is such a long, hard process, something I'm not used to. My African family's patience with the demands of this lifestyle is admirable. They'll spend all afternoon and part of the evening preparing a meal, and then 30 minutes after they set the food out, the children are scraping the crusty rice out of the bottom of the pot. But that process... the ground has to be softened, the seeds have to be planted, the rains must come, and the family has to tend to the growth. When the green stalks have finished their growth and then brown with death, the people go out to the fields to harvest the grain. With their hatchets balanced on their heads and bottles filled with murky water swinging at their sides and babies sleeping tied hard against their backs, they, the women, work those fields. The women work harder than you men do, I told my lazy African brothers. Women, they get up early, sweep the courtyard, cook the breakfast, take care of the children, work the rice fields, come home, make dinner, host guests. They do everything. What do? David, a lean African brother with little ambition, said, Well, we built the houses. That's one thing, I replied with a smile. Emily, you don't know, David said, defending his gender. Well, maybe I don't know the whole story, but I do know that the women work hard out there. The women, they work those fields. And yes, the men do too, and the children. Really everyone, because this is everyone's business. Food in the belly is everyone's business. After the stalks are cut, they're tied in bundles and left in the sun to dry for several days. Next, they're hauled to the center of the field, which becomes the threshing floor. There, in what might be the most physically demanding part of the process, the harvesters thresh the rice, slamming the bundles onto the ground with back-breaking effort. They call it tapping the rice, but really they're beating it. It's almost as if they're punishing it. The process breaks the sheathed kernels from the stalk, and the harvester sweeps the freed rice kernels into piles, loads them into basins, and then carries them home, where they spread them out on tarps to dry some more, and then they pound them like Dingo is doing, stripping off the sheaths, the chaff. Sometimes two or even three people stand around a bowl throwing that stick, that wooden pole, down on the rice, taking turns and breaks and turns again. Sometimes the pounding will go on for an hour. Pound, heave, pass, next, blister, pound. I've joined them many times, but I know they're just humoring me. I suppose they think it's humorous as well. I mean, I'm awkward and unpracticed. I didn't learn this as a kid. At one break, I show my sisters the blisters on my hands, and they laughed and called Mama Jolie over. But she didn't laugh at me. Instead, she ran her fingers over the blisters and shook her head back and forth. Those blisters that formed on my callus-free fingers were testaments to the fact that the changing of the state of the rice is no easy process, and the process does greatly change the rice. When they think they've pounded the rice enough, they lift a bowl filled with the rice and chaff kernels high, and then they pour the mixture out, allowing the wind to blow the chaff away while the kernels, the eyes of the rice, fall into a bowl on the ground. Sometimes, when the air is still, they'll run down the road, pouring the rice and chaff from one bowl to another and letting the wind created by their running blow the chaff away. In the evenings, you can then find thick trails of chaff on the roadside alongside the huts. At this point, they remove impurities, shaking the eyes of the rice and scanning them carefully. Get it all out, all the rocks and all the sticks, all the bugs. After they've gotten rid of the big stuff, they pour the rice into a bowl of water to be washed, gently. Dinga scolds me for rushing this part, for sloshing water all over the place. She washes in this way that's almost artful, and the rocks that we may have missed in the picking out stage, they sink to the bottom of the bowl, and then they pour off the pure rice. At this point, the rice is clean and bare, stripped of all that had covered it. It's ready to be cooked, boiled. The last step, it's the softening, swelling, sterilizing step. We're plagued by giardia and worms, by typhoid and amoebas. The boiling helps to prevent protruding worm bellies, persistent diarrhea, and feverish suffering. What a variety of treatments the rice is exposed to. What a trip it goes on from the beginning of its existence to the end. One moment the stalks are being hacked down, and the next someone is picking out all the contaminants. One moment the kernels are being pounded, and the next they're being washed. But after all the pounding, sifting, washing, the rice swells as it's being boiled. It swells to be something more than it was, and in that we're thankful for each step of the process. And here in the midst of this sometimes hell, sometimes heaven place, I feel like my own heart has gone on a trip. One that's left it totally exposed. It's as if someone played soccer with it and then rubbed it against a cheese grater, then gave it a nice warm bath, threw it a birthday party, and then made it run a marathon. Things here in this village and hospital make me feel and think things I've never thought or felt before. I didn't know that welling up, uncontainable, giggly contentment could get inside of me like it has, but a baby was born into my hands, screaming in pinky brown. I also didn't know the whirling, gut-tingling, skin-tightening, pinchy-eyed sorrow that humans can feel until I listened to a baby's silent, still chest through my stethoscope and realized that death was certain. We can't tell what effect exposure will have on people. Sometimes it seems to strengthen them immediately, like the rising to the challenge effect. Other times it takes a long while for its effects to show up, and still other times the effects of exposure to life's extremes begins right away and then never seems to let up. Many of our why questions don't get answered on this earth, which can turn our search for answers into a desperate grasp at peace, something that we'll only find when we set our gaze on someone and someplace beyond our full comprehension. When I bump into the walls of our shower room, dirt sticks to my wet skin and it's frustrating. I want my shower to bring equal cleanliness to my whole body, and the fact that my feet never get beyond a light shade of brown, it bothers me. It isn't comfortable here. There isn't enough sanitation, nor enough privacy. But in some ways, the very things which make me so uncomfortable also bring me so much comfort. At night, when I've finished my shift during which I've become convinced that humankind can't dodge hardships, I come home from the hospital and shower. Sometimes I dunk my whole head in the bucket and hold it underwater for a few seconds. A silly thing to do, really, but it drowns out all sounds, all noises, and something about it makes me feel like I'm sticking my head out of a window of a house that's filled with smoke. It's like I'm getting a breath of fresh air or something. Once I've gotten my whole head wet, I pour water over the rest of my body, and those bars of soap that my mom assured me that I'd need really have come in handy. I just want those odors to come off. The stench of the penicillin that shot out of cheap syringes and flows into and burns the veins of the woman who, without it, will die of worse. The stench of the sweaty bodies that have gone unbathed for far too long. The odors that trigger the pictures of the patients that we left at shift's end. In this African shower room, I just feel too exposed. But there's a part of me that, at night, when I really need to know that there's something greater out there, wants nothing more than to be exposed to the night sky and its white lights, wants nothing more for the truth to be that the ceiling is high and that hope lies there, beyond things seen. And when I'm done showering, still grasping my shampoo bottle, some soft, smoky scent drifts over the low shower wall, and the laugh of some wild child trickles over it too, and I'm thankful for the low walls, for the ceilingless shower. We're exposed to the stars and the urine, the hellish and the holy, the pleasant and the un, the pounding and the washing, the sifting and the boiling. What you'll read in the following pages is a collage of both. People are good. Here I am. I'm 22. I'm heading to Chad, Africa to work for 6 months at a hospital in the village of Bere. I'll be filling a nursing position, though I'm not a nurse. I'm impulsive, a slight bit disorganized, have a bad memory, a big fear of dogs, a little fear of the dark, and this itch inside me to please people. Those are some of the things that our Father in Heaven is going to have to deal with this year. Sometimes I wonder if wanting to help is enough. Does willingness really equal usefulness? Will he turn my weaknesses into strengths? Will he just use me in my weakness? When fear of failing seeps in, will he remind me what courage feels like? Will I somehow be brave and step up to big, tough, scary tasks? Will he teach me how to turn these anxieties into prayers? Will he? I'm banking on it. I said goodbye to my parents, Joyce and Keith, and to my boyfriend, Alex, at the airport. I'd already said goodbyes to my brother and friends, but these last goodbyes, they seemed harder and more final. My mom reminded me that these were happy goodbyes because I'm beginning such a neat experience, and we'll see each other in no time. We're rather optimistic people. So instead of crying, we smiled with puddles in our eyes. My mom sneaked all sorts of things into my bags. I'm finding baby dolls, wooden giraffes, orange purses containing quarters, string, an emergency siren, and a million bars of soap. I don't even use bar soap at home, but she assures me that I'll use it, and I'll bet she's right. My mom comes from this line of unique, creative, artistic, slightly wild, and yet extremely capable women. She's an actor, a musician, a painter, a woodcarver, a museum docent, a seamstress, and a rock hound. As we were driving on one of our family vacations, my mom screamed, "Stop the car!" She said that she'd just seen a beaver on the side of the road, roadkill, and that she wanted to get the tail and have a taxidermist stuff it. Then she said that she let the kids at church see a beaver's tail up close and that they could feel it. My dad said, "Joyce," but knowing how persistent she is, he pulled over to the side of the road and told her that there was a hatchet in the trunk. She did actually hack the tail off, sending beaver blubber flying all around. Do you see what I mean? Yet, despite all this seeming eclecticness, my mom's one of the most organized, thorough, and thoughtful people I've ever met. Her love pours itself into the service of people around her, and I felt that as she did everything she could to help me prepare for Africa and to get there. So many other people did the same. It seems like I've had an army behind me, but as I was getting on that plane, I realized that that army couldn't get on the plane with me, so I was gonna have to stuff their good courage and best wishes into my pockets to pull out when I got dropped into the pits. My seat was next to Courtney, a makeup artist on her way to Paris. She's created a lip gloss, and listening to her talk passionately about the colors, ingredients, and effects of her product started me dreaming in a way that just hasn't ended yet. People who do what they love are magnetic and inspiring. I want to do a lot of wondering about my career this next year. Sometimes I'm afraid that I'll end up doing what I should and miss what could have been. I arrived in Washington, D.C. at 3 in the afternoon, and when I checked onto my flight to Africa, I found that it had been delayed. Instead of leaving at 8:30 at night, it was scheduled to depart at 2 in the morning. Ugh! With so much time to kill, I decided to see something of our nation's capital. I asked about the best way to get into the city, and a chatty woman in a crisp airport uniform told me that taxis charge $40 one way. Yikers! She recommended that I try to bum a ride on one of the free airport shuttles. Ah, thrifty and resourceful. I lugged my huge backpack almost half a mile to the H2 station and asked Scotty, the Comfort Inn driver, when the next shuttle would leave for the hotel. He said, "Soon," and asked me where I was staying, what room I was staying in. I stammered, "Well, I don't exactly have a reservation, but could I please have a ride, though? I'd like to leave the airport, but taxis are so expensive." Scotty said that he had nice bones in his body, and with that, he opened the door and pointed me to the front passenger seat. While we waited for the van to fill up, Scotty peppered me with questions about my trip. Then, just as we were pulling away, a woman ran up to my window and slipped a $20 bill through, saying that she had heard us talking about where I was going, and she wanted to give me the money because everyone needs help once in a while. People are so good. A whole airline crew was riding the shuttle to the hotel. An entertaining conversation soon sprouted. The slightly abrasive yet funny senior pilot asked me where I was going. As I told him what I knew about my destination, he began to give me a stream of reasons that I was crazy, concluding, "You're nuts, girl. There's no way I would ever go there." Suddenly, I felt a bit nervous. Had I overlooked the risk? Hadn't I given this decision to go enough thought? Deborah, one of the flight attendants, rolled her eyes a bit at the pilot and reassured me. She said I was brave and that I shouldn't listen to what others were saying. I appreciated what she said so much, and she etched her mark inside me. I met lots of nice people in D.C. I did a variety of things, among them tripping in a crosswalk directly in front of loads of traffic, landing face down with my huge backpack on top of me. The ground has never come at me so fast. I couldn't do anything but laugh and wave to all the drivers who, though sympathetic, were impatiently waiting for me to get out of the way. When I finished wandering D.C., I made my way back to the Comfort Inn, hoping to catch Scotty in another ride back to the airport. When I asked where he was, though, I was told that his shift had ended. Max, who was driving during the evening shift, asked me where I needed to go. I told him I needed to catch a plane, and he said, "All right, I'll take you." I felt bad, though, because I wasn't even staying at the hotel, and I was going to be the only passenger on the whole 10-person shuttle. So I confessed. I told Max that I wasn't a customer of the hotel. He smiled and said that it was no problem, that he wasn't doing anything anyway, so that he'd take me back to the airport. Once again, people are so good. I slept through most of my 15-hour flight to Africa, but I didn't get to Chad right away. I spent a day and a half delayed in Ethiopia. The airline put me up in a hotel and fed me 3 meals a day of good rice, veggies, eggs, soup, fresh bread, salad, yogurt, and hot cocoa. One morning, two other volunteers and I took a taxi and went all over town. It's a different world here. That's all I can say for right now. I can tell I'm starting to process all these things that I'm seeing. I just wrote a paragraph about the thoughts that have been going through my mind, but I found myself backspacing them away because they don't make sense. I haven't made sense of it yet. People who have traveled to second and third world countries know exactly what I'm talking about and what things I'll have to process. What about all these beggars? They're not begging for money or drugs. These are legitimately needy people who want food. What about those sad lions we saw at the Addis Zoo? They look so unhappy. What about this defensive mode of mine? This feeling that everyone's out to get me in one way or another? Should I have this attitude? Does it make me safe? It doesn't seem to fit with focusing on others rather than myself. Sort, sort, sort. File this thought here. Dismiss that one. Dwell on this one. Yes, this one matters. Ugh, this is just the beginning. We arrive. I've arrived. When we flew into the capital, N'Djamena, and stepped off the plane, a wall of heat hit my body. The desert is trying to suck me dry already, and I found myself sipping at my Nalgene and wiping sweat droplets from my forehead with my wrist before they slid into my eyes. Levi, a strong, confident Chadian and an employee of the hospital in Bere, was sent to make sure we found our way safely. We trusted him completely because we had no other choice. We don't speak French, and English is rare. We rode a bus for 7 hours. When the bus ride ended, we were greeted by moto drivers who surrounded us and our baggage on all sides. Each begged, saying that they'd take us for a good price and grabbing our bags before we agreed. Levi handled everything evenly, with a calm that I'm gonna have to thank him for later. I imagine doing this on my own, and then I stop because it's a bad thought. Finally, Levi agrees with certain drivers on a fair price, and our bags were bungeed down too high behind us on mopeds. For the rest of our trip, we were wheeling down roads that looked like lakes. We are arriving at the end of a short wet season. After I surrendered to the idea of death by moto wreck and decided to trust my driver fully, everything became more fun. I said to myself awfully naively, I don't want this to ever end. Ansley Howe was on the moto in front of me. Ansley is an extremely brave 24-year-old nurse from Maryland. She's of medium height and has brown curls that love this humid atmosphere. Our fathers went to medical school together, but while those ties already exist, they'll be cinched down this next year. I know that she'll be my shoulder, and I'll try to be hers. Ansley's moto driver seemed to be stopping to drink something from a small bottle that he kept in a brown paper sack. With one waft, Ansley knew that her driver was drinking a fairly strong intoxicant and coupling it with driving, and while we laughed a bit at the new set of rules, or perhaps the abandonment of all the ones we're used to, it also made us nervous. And there were wrecks. Numerous ones left Ansley and me knee-deep in water, with our skirts hiked up hilltops in complete disregard for the no-knees-showing cultural faux pas. Our bags, by some grace not granted by our drivers, stayed relatively dry. At one point, well after nightfall, we stopped briefly. When I looked down at the monster puddles in our trail, I saw that the stars were bouncing back their reflection off the water, leaving white dots on the surface. And though it may sound cliched, it was perfect. My bum hurt wickedly as we neared our destination, and I was no longer wishing for a never-ending moto ride. All my anticipatory nerves had wilted in those 3 hours. But as we arrived at the 70-bed hospital in the village of Bere, those nerves were once again livened. Two young men, volunteers as well, unloaded my bags, and I followed them as they dragged the bags down a dusty road and turned left into a cluster of huts. Even though it was past their bedtime, an uncountable number of quiet African children greeted me with timid stares. But their shyness was okay for now. We don't share a language yet. A quiet woman led me to my hut and swung a tin door open for me, and I walked into this empty, dark space. The interior smelled like a musky greenhouse, that combo of hot air and wet dirt. A cot sat against one wall, and a white mosquito net haphazardly flopped in a pile at its foot. And that was it. And in one way, well, actually not in just one way, in most ways, I'm happy that I've been given such a bare beginning. Emptiness is a good conductor. My friend Trina told me that when I was at a really low point, feeling like all life had been dumped out of me. I've been carved and defined by a busy life. Like most American 20-somethings, a life densely populated by required experiences, appointments, college years, extracurriculars, and stuff, good and bad, that just happens. And it all shapes us. It's been a life that many people might might call cluttered, and sometimes I think I do a lot of reacting to whatever comes my way instead of acting and choosing for myself. I don't think it's all clutter, but yes, life can become so busy that those things and experiences are choosing who you become. So this emptiness, it was a new side to things. Emptiness is the most intentional conductor. Clean canvases make the most original paintings, and pure, straight-up water is the best thing for you anyway. I was tired that night, and without any socialization, eating, or setting up of camp, I fell asleep on my cot, curled up in a ball. Now, as I'm writing this here in the morning, my ankles and feet, which were uncovered during the night, are peppered with mosquito bites. I'm nervous what this emptiness will be filled with. Nervous with grand attempts at courage. First evening. It's my first full evening in my new home, and I'm already crying. I'm usually not much of a crier, but tonight I just can't plug my eyes. As dusk settled in, they put me in my dark mud hut to eat alone. Supposedly, it's a real honor to get to eat like this, to have your own bowl of food and not be disturbed by the joyous noise of happy children. They definitely don't know me yet. The food is so unfamiliar. It's a huge ball of rice resembling half a volleyball. The rice is called bul. No one told me how to eat this. I started by using a fork to cut off chunks of the rice ball and then chewing them down. Then, about halfway through the meal, I discovered a sauce in a tiny pot. When I tasted that, I could tell it was fish in a slimy liquid. Feeling queasy, I continued eating the rice plain. They won't let me do a thing for myself. When I walk out of my hut, three sweet Africans get up, young and old alike, and they get off of whatever they're sitting on, and then they run it over to me. If I'm carrying something, five people come to relieve me. It's just overwhelming. Oh, and then there's my French. I can't say anything except thank you. I'm rarely understood. Even when I try seven different pronunciations of the letters in the English-French dictionary and use different tones and volumes coupled with hand motions and sound effects, all I get back are blank stares and fake nods of understanding. It seems like I'm in a glass room all by myself. I can see everything that's going on around me, but my eyes are the only sense of any use these days. These ears should come with translators.
You've been listening to African Rice Heart, a young woman's journal of radical service. It was written and read by Emily Wilkins and published by Pacific Press Publishing Association, copyright 2011. Join us again next time on The Bookshelf.